I'm very happy to tell you something that I learned from the committee which has charge of the Centennial Essay Contest, that there are 52 essays were submitted in that enterprise. That either represents an intellectual renaissance or the fact that people need money. I don't know which. But at any rate, it's a fairly significant fact. Last summer, I had 3 days vacation. So in October, that shows how my mind is rested. I decided that I would combine a business trip to the West Coast with a part vacation, which I took. And the first place I headed for was the first place I would head for if I had my choice of a thing like that, the redwood forests of California. And there among the redwood forests, what I'm saying this morning evolved, for better or for worse, crowded and a little bit urged on by the fact that I knew I had to speak in Cleveland Sunday as the sixth and final speaker in a series on the subject of excellence. But this was really intended, first of all, for myself. There's one thing to do on a vacation outside of sleep and all the rest that goes with it. You just ask yourself one question. Clears the air as nothing else will. Among all the guff and all the externals and all the give and take, what do you really think is important? And what I think is important is what I call this thing, the glory of the imperfect. And the title, as you know, is not original. But I'm not thinking this morning of William James. I'm thinking rather of what I thought there among the redwood trees of John Ruskin's wonderful account in The Stones of Venice of Gothic architecture. You know, the term Gothic was once a term of reproach because men whose minds were better than their hands worked away on great cathedrals that were controlled by a series of master designers, but the individual workman was not always up to it. And so a characteristic of rudeness and savagery was early associated with Gothic architecture. There is another theory of all this that I won't take time for this morning. But Ruskin's conclusion for his purpose is that it is this very rudeness of Gothic architecture is one of the noblest characteristics of any architecture that you could call Christian. Ruskin says, no good work whatever can be perfect because no good man ever stops working till he has reached his point of failure. And if he doesn't reach the point of failure, he is not a success. His mind is always in advance of his powers of execution. Winston Churchill's aunt used to say about him, you know, and she was a very astute observer. She said, anybody can be with Winston Churchill 1 hour and you know every fault he has, and there are many. But it takes a whole lifetime with Winston Churchill to discover his virtues. And Ruskin says, if we are to have great men working at all, or lesser men doing their best, which is the same thing, the work will be imperfect, however beautiful, because imperfection is the sign of life in a mortal body, of all progress and of all change. And then this sentence, which I almost memorized the first time I read it many years ago. All things are literally better, lovelier, and more beloved for the imperfections which have been divinely appointed, that the law of human life may be effort, and the law of human judgment may be mercy. In short, the glory of imperfection arises when excellence has not been settled for at too low a pace. Now, obviously, there has to be some horse sense in any meditation of this kind. The glory of the imperfect is not a wild-eyed, romantic glory of being a perpetual darn fool or of making blunders 10 feet in front of your own eyes because your eyes are so resolutely glued to the far horizons. It is not the glory of the mere visionary. We rightly honor competence and good accurate performance and the habit of mastery and the infinite pains that lead to all kinds of freedom. Personally, I like doors that open and windows that shut and even cellophane that you can eventually break through. I don't want my carpenter or my grocer or my airplane pilot or my surgeon, of all people, to be brooding unduly on the glory of the imperfect. I said to the dean of a medical school not long ago, I said, how can the passing grade in medical school be less than 100%? And he said, well, of course it can't be. He said, you don't expect a man when he comes up for examination to have everything in his head that he needs to know. He said, what we want a graduate of a medical school to do is be able to know where to go to get what he needs to know. And I said, yes, and I'm lying on the operating table. I can just see it now. The surgeon stopping in midair when he hits a new convolution and saying, will someone please go to the library and look at volume 3? And the interesting thing is, as you think about a subject like this, you know what, one way it does you good is you come to a new conviction that there's some things that you're not going to be exonerated for. That you can't palm them off with that beautiful little sentence that we all use. There are two sentences in modern life that are the sign to me of spiritual decay. One is, it isn't relevant. Ye gods, relevance is a two-way street. And if you don't go down your half of it, you'll never meet it. And the other one is, oh, well, it's so human. Not human, it's animal. We use the word, a great word, like the word human, to describe our weaknesses. Human, a word that's been fought for over the centuries by the hard-won culture conquests of men. And we use it as a palm and a massage. I don't think there's anybody can console himself with the idea that you can't believe that peace is obtainable. I don't believe we're going to be exonerated for not reestablishing law in American life in a society that's worthy of law. I don't believe we're going to be exonerated whenever we omit some kind of care for the injured and the oppressed. And certainly now that we know we can, the chance to give at least people the chance of a reasonably decent life. George Washington Carver used to say that there are some things that good men can labor at that make heaven seem at least a little less problematical. I began to think out there among the redwoods about what a man knows that he can do. I recommend this to you, a line of meditation. You know, the appalling thing is that a man knows he can be honest. He can feel compassion. That he can serve other people. That he can create. In some degree. One thing he knows is that he can have loyalties and that he can love the things that are worthy to be loved. These are possible. There's no exemption, no exoneration from that because they're in our power. What I'm thinking of rather this morning, however, is something that becomes a quite different and much more subtle spiritual matter. And it's a little hard to state. In every human life, it seems to me A man should always be working at something that he knows he can't possibly get done. That there should be a margin of creative distance beyond talent, beyond competence, beyond calculated success, where a spirit is stretching itself beyond its known marks. Now, it's bound to be in your vocation. That's one nice thing. In the thing that's your job, you know this will happen automatically. A chemist can no longer even be a chemist, my friends tell me, in the explosion of knowledge. You remember that sonnet of Shakespeare of all people, where he tells how low he is in his mind, desiring this man's art and that man's scope. Imagine that. In other words, Shakespeare wishing that he could write like the other Elizabethan. It's automatic in your business. Where I think it ought to be also is in other areas, in some avocation. Some avocation where you know you'll never make the grade. I leave out, of course, the much too subtle question of all human relationships. I'll use a personal illustration and not apologize for it. 6 years ago, I decided that I wanted to have, as I ran around the country on my job, the four quartets of Beethoven in my head, the four last quartets. Oh, I have worked at this. I have sat before a phonograph with a score, and when I think of how easy this would be for so many of you, I burn with envy. This isn't my ability. I suppose I have maybe 90% of one of those in my head. I don't think I'll ever get the other 10 in. I swear I won't. There are times when I can't even tell whether it's the viola or the cello playing, and that leaves you in a high and dry place. But you know, I wouldn't have missed that for anything, and I'm still working at it. And the other night, when we heard this fine execution of some of these, where the people were turning the corners on two wheels, seeing people doing something that you know you could never do yourself or never even really understand yourself, that's wonderful. And I want you to see why this is important. And this is the thing that hit me hardest as I looked up through those 2,000-year-old trees. The glory of the imperfect is such a useful thing because it will perpetually remind you of four other things. One, the fact that we just don't bring our lives off on our own power. If that's a discovery a man has to make, he has to wait for it. I'm afraid some people have to wait for that. I don't have to wait any longer. I know this. Two, with that, the gratitude that you feel when you know that you can't do things on your own power. When we have a borrowed life, that's a free gift. Speaking of Shakespeare, the thing that Shakespeare hated more than anything else in life, it seems to me, was the idea of ingratitude. And the feeling of just rudimentary gratitude is so important because it cancels pride. You can't be a proud person fundamentally. Oh, you can be cocky about a few things, but you can't really be proud, fundamentally proud, and be grateful. It's impossible. And if pride is original sin, isn't it wonderful to be able to take that giant theological step at one simple way? The third thing I think it gives you is a reawakened sense of the idea of immortality. You and I know 100% is, and we've never seen it. And yet the greatest secular argument, well, no, wait a minute, There are those behind me who would argue with me. I'll put that in a more cautious way. One of the important arguments for immortality is the argument that our minds are made so that they work in a certain way before experience ever strikes them. I can look at two objects forever, and if my mind's just a wax plate, when did I ever learn to say one is more beautiful than the other? Your mind contains things that confers things on experience. Time, place, causation, modality, quality, quantity. And one of the things our minds seem to possess before we've ever had the chance for that experience is the idea of 100% or perfection, which we have never seen. Therefore, some of the claims that the great religions have, but they're maybe true or false, but to human beings, they should not come as a particular surprise. As Browning says in Andrea del Sarto, his account of the faultless Italian painter who could do anything with his, in a moment and yet never really did it. He says, man's reach should exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for? And then I think the fourth thing that at least it seemed to me emerged was the realization that the only strange thing about the character of our Lord is that there was no strangeness about him, whatever else, except the strangeness of perfection. I always shudder when I hear some well-meaning friend speak of another friend and in appreciation, and all this is well-intended, and the person says, oh, she's such a Christ-like character. Oh, my. Isn't that awful? I think that's pure blasphemy. Because the difference is so great. There's a man we tried to get here a few years ago, and I don't know why he didn't come. I'm speaking of Loren Isley, the wonderful anthropologist who can write like an angel and does know what he's talking about, which is a help. I have in my hand here a little book that I can so warmly commend to you if you haven't read it, that it's almost the main purpose of the morning, a book called The Immense Journey. You know that? Let me read you two paragraphs from it. I think we'd better get it. If the day comes when the slime of the laboratory for the first time crawls under man's direction, we shall have great need of humbleness. It'll be difficult for us to believe in our pride of achievement that the secret of life has slipped through our fingers and eludes us still. We will list all the chemicals and the reactions, and the men who have become gods will pose austerely before the popping flash bulbs of news photographers. And there will be very few around then to consider, so deep is the mindset of an age, whether the desire to link life to matter may not have blinded us to the more remarkable characteristics of both. As for me, if I'm still around on that day, I intend to put on my old hat and climb over the wall as usual. I shall see strange mechanisms lying as they lie here now in the autumn rain, strange pipes that transported the substance of life, the intricate seed case out of which life has flown. I shall observe no thing green, no delicate transpirations of leaves, nor subtle comings and goings of vapor, and the little sunlit factories of the chloroplasts will have dissolved into bare earth. Beautiful, angular, and bare, the machinery of life will lie exposed, as it is now, to my view. It is said by men who know about these things At the smallest living cell probably contains over 250,000 protein molecules engaged in the multitudinous coordinated activities which make up the phenomenon of life. At the instant of death, whether of man or microbe, that ordered, incredible spinning passes away in an almost furious haste of those same particles to get themselves back into the chaotic, unplanned earth. I do not think if someone finally twists the keys successfully in the tiniest and most humble house of life, that many of these questions will ever be answered, or that the dark forces which create lights in the deep sea and living batteries in the waters of tropical swamps, or the dead cycles of parasites, or the most noble workings of the human brain will be much, if at all, revealed. Rather, I would say that if dead matter has reared up this curious landscape of fiddling crickets, song sparrows, and wondering men, it must be plain even to the most devoted materialist that the matter of which he speaks contains amazing, if not dreadful, powers, and may not impossibly be, as Thomas Hardy has suggested, but one mask of many worn by the great face behind. Our Father in heaven, out of the great distance that lies between thee and us, help us to discern the true lineaments of our imagination. Also help us to discern the mercy that must follow and does follow in this arrangement. The mercy that we know not as some proposition of our own thinking, but out of an event in history that made this clear. We ask that thy blessing be upon us in all our own work, that what we may do may be done as well as we can, and that the rest may be committed unto thee. We ask in Jesus' name.